This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box, your podcast home for a deep cut discussion of genre films from the VHS era. From action to horror to sci-fi, these are the films that you rented from Mom and Pop's video store, or maybe you left them on the shelf altogether to collect dust, left wondering if you're missing out on a buried treasure. Shame on you. This is the show that unburies that treasure, and I'm one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week we will have a review of the 1994 working of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, directed by and starring Kenneth Branagh, and also starring Robert De Niro. So how does Frankenstein hold up after 23 years? Does Kenneth Branagh understand the term subtlety? Yeah. Check out the review right now over at RetroMovieNerd.com. With me, as always, is your other co-host, the dude with attitude, the guy you can't buy, the Ayatollah of pop cultura, Joel La Puma.
But Chris, am I truly a bad enough dude to save the president?
Oh, you're a bad dude, man.
Yes.
You're so bad. You eat glass.
And wear a power glove. And you could find me at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com. And this week I'll finally have a review of Hudson Horror Show 15 up for you.
Oh yes, awesome. Been looking forward to that, Joel.
Yeah.
Can't wait to check it out. Well, we're going to traipse on over to the new release section, Joel, to kick things off. Kind of a light week this week. Not too many servings out there in the Blu-ray DVD realm for retro releases, that is. Bigger ones from Mill Creek, who are, you know, quite adept at glutting the retro release market with their multi-movie sets. This week they put out a Steven Seagal, Jean-Claude Van Damme set they call Head to Head. 8 movies. Mostly a mix of Steven Seagal and Van Damme's latter day, more recent workings, you know, whatever Seagal is doing over there in Russia. hanging out with Putin, making movies. Keeping the Red Square in check, I'm sure. And a couple of Van Damme movies on there that might be of note from, you know, his later 90s run, before his star started to fade there a little bit. Maximum Risk is on there, as well as Double Team with Dennis Rodman.
And actually, those despite the presence of Dennis Rodman and Double Team and the presence of Jean-Claude Van Damme and both, those actually have some great directors behind them. Maximum Risk is Ringo Lam, and Double Team is Sui Hark.
Yeah, how about that? Sui Hark, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? That's right. I did not remember that until you just mentioned it. That's a good call.
Yeah, and that was his first American film, actually. Unfortunately, huge bomb, and it also starred Dennis Rodman for some reason that only the 90s can explain.
Well, that was that time period, but, I guess. I don't know if Rodman was still in the NBA at that point, but he was, you know, making his way into the movie world with this, and I think he was hanging out with Hulk Hogan and the NWO and WCW at that time.
Fighting DDP and Karl Malone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know why that matches the love it does. Yeah, at least it's better than DDP and Jay Leno.
Oh God!
You know, as a team.
And you know, I thought Jay Leno could really pull that off. He needed Pat Morita there.
That's right. You needed Pat Morita in his corner. Wax on, Jay. Sony this week putting out yet another version of True Romance, and a True Romance is a good film. You know, it's written by Tarantino and it's got his fingerprints all over it. I enjoyed it myself. I've reviewed it on RetroMovieNerd.com in the past. Go look at my archives; it's in there. But if you don't have a copy of True Romance, you know, now would be a good time to pick one up with this new release. And then Warner is putting out, once again, with new box art this time, the complete run of the Tales from the Crypt series, which I think everyone remembers that fondly. I mean, I know I do. But yeah, I think that's definitely worth a pickup. The individual seasons are available as well as the complete set together.
Oh, yeah. Actually, honestly, I would say it's a good pickup no matter what, but you can get the individual seasons for such a low price at this point. Until the full set goes down in a few months, like if you're really desperate to watch Tales from the Crypt now, I would just pick up the individual seasons.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why they put out the new box art, because, you know, Warner's like, hey, everybody, look, new cool box. You don't have this one. So, yeah, it's just a cash-in by Warner, of course.
Oh, yeah, I mean, if I recall, they're supposed to be rebooting Tales for TNT, maybe? With M. Night Shyamalan as the showrunner or executive producer, so I'm guessing this is sort of just priming the pump for that.
Yeah, they need to put it on at midnight on Friday or Saturday night, though.
Oh, I know.
That's the only way I remember it, you know, late at night on a weekend. If it's on at like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the evening on like a Tuesday, forget about it. Yeah, it's not the same.
No. We've also got, speaking of Ringo Lam and Sui Hark, there's a couple new releases from those two. We've got Sky on Fire from Ringo Lam, which is an action flick of his from last year I haven't seen. And Sui Hark has a sequel to Stephen Chow's Journey in the West. I haven't seen the sequel yet, but the original was really phenomenal. Yeah, and a really interesting revisionist take on the classic Journey to the West myth. A really good movie. I expect this to be similar in tone and style. I mean, him and Stephen Chow, their styles are very compatible, so I think that'll work really well. We've got a new collector's edition, a Blu-ray DVD box set of Akira. I've got the previous Blu-ray, which is pretty great quality. I don't know if this has a lot of new special features or if it's just probably some kind of 30th anniversary thing.
Yeah, and Akira, you know, if you're into anime and you haven't checked out Akira, you know, in a lot of circles it's considered one of the greatest anime features of all time. So, yeah, it's got that going for it.
Yeah, it's definitely a foundational work and one of the greatest manga of all time. I mean, it's just a really fantastic, huge story, like just incredible scope. Definitely worth looking up even if you're not familiar with anime. And speaking of anime, there's a collection of all three Mobile Suit Gundam films on Blu-ray, which looks like a pretty decent value. It's about $30-$35 for the three films, which is also a really good introduction to one of the bigger anime franchises out there.
Yeah. Now, I remember Mobile Suit Gundam from several years ago. I have a stepson who is big into Gundam. And the series when it was on Cartoon Network several years ago.
Yeah, if you're like for someone my age or slightly younger, probably have fond memories watching the Gundam shows, especially Gundam Wing on Cartoon Network Toonami block. I mean, for a lot of us, I think that was a really foundational introduction to anime.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of listeners out there that might be quite interested in that set. Especially from that generation.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's not a big week this week, but in terms of Asian films being imported, it's actually pretty solid. I don't know if we're just, last week was a big week for a lot of cult genre stuff. There seems to be a lot of new releases of newer horror films this week, and I don't know enough about most of them to actually give recommendation.
Yeah, I try to avoid some of the newer stuff on this show, of course, since we like to talk about the VHS era and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, there are people who are interested in maybe some of the more indie horror films that are coming out now. We might take on a future show. We might take a look at some of those, some more notable ones, because I know that I get movie screeners in my email from indie distributors and wanted me to review their stuff. I don't. But regardless of that, there's still quite a few interesting things there that I might actually get around to plugging. So, you know, in future shows, you know, we might add a new format to that. So just keep your ears open for that. With that being said, we are going to do a little something different this week. As Joel and I have made a list. You know, everyone loves lists, Joel. I love a good list. You love a good list, Joel?
It's what the internet's built on now.
The internet is built on lists. It's powered by lists. It's like if you want to write a piece, an article on the internet, it's got to have a list in it or no one pays attention to it. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of gibberish. So we've got a little criteria for this. We call it, what should we call it? Our 10 movies you must see. Yeah, I think that's a good one. Basically, the criteria for this list, however, is these are films that we are quite fond of, but you may or may not have seen them. Like, we both love Star Wars. We both love the Star Wars saga. I'm a big fan of The Lord of the Rings, but everyone has seen them thanks to cable. TNT, TBS, whatever. Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and Indiana Jones, I mean, all that stuff would wind up on my personal favorites list, but everyone's seen them. And I mean, what's the point of a recommendation if everyone has seen it, right?
Yeah, I mean, my personal favorites list, I mean, how hard is it to suggest someone go watch Jaws or Aliens? Everyone's seen those.
Yeah. So, now, myself, on my list, I've made a few exceptions for some of personal favorites that are a little more well-known than some others on the list. However, they are probably overshadowed by the works of the director or the star and other features. Maybe don't get enough love when we're talking about the filmography of the director. And so, you know, I cheated just a little and added these films just because I just could not bear to keep them off my list. And what about your list, Joel?
Well, one of the things that I focused on heavily was films that they might have DVD or even Blu-ray releases, but not notable ones and not perfect ones. So I tried to avoid anything that, like, Criterion put out or Scream Factory put out, even if I think they're underseen films, just because, like, if they have a really notable release, I think people are going to be able to find it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. The one slight exception I made in that is my number one choice, because I think it is kind of overshadowed, and it's also part of a bigger set. But yeah, a lot of the ones I picked have DVD or even Blu-ray releases, but they're just not as easily accessible. As, like, you know, I didn't put things like I might have otherwise put, like, People Under the Stairs or Pumpkinhead on the list, or Lady Snowblood I didn't put on the list, because Criterion has that really nice set that everyone pretty much knows about at this point.
Yeah, I almost put Pumpkinhead on my list because, you know, that's one of those films that, you know, when it's on, I just got to watch it.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, I mean, and it was recently on Comet TV, and of course I had it on and I watched it. So, yeah, but unfortunately I left it off my list for other fare.
Yeah, and one of the films that I almost put on the list that for distribution issues is actually Ringu, the original Japanese ring.
Oh, yes, okay.
I kept it off because it's... Who doesn't know about it at this point? I mean, it's a huge franchise, but there's no American Blu-ray release. There's no Blu-ray release internationally with any English subtitles.
Right, so basically a watchable version for an American audience would be hard to find.
You can find out of print DVDs. That's not too bad. But it seems to be held up by rights issues to get a really nice Blu-ray release in America. So just something to think about. I mean, everyone pretty much knows the deal with the ring and how popular it is. But you know, it's surprisingly inaccessible to get a good version to watch yourself.
Right. But, okay.
But I kept it off the list because. I mean, we've had so many American remakes of it. Like, it's mimetic. Everyone knows the movie, so.
Right. So, yeah. So, yeah, that's some of the criteria for our list. It just has to be a personal favorite, and maybe you have not seen it and compared to other works by the same filmmakers. So, and that's basically it. So, you've got thousands of movies to choose from, because... let's just face it, there's just way too many movies that I would recommend that, just to pare it down to 10 was a chore, but I think I came up with a pretty good list, Joel.
Yeah, I had so much trouble paring this down to 10, and I'm kicking myself even looking at my list now for the things I left off, but I think I got a passable one here.
Yeah, I think we could also probably extend this into a future show as well, where we can come up with more lists. And I think that's the key to life, is just more lists.
Soon we'll be writing for Cracked.
Yeah, hopefully we won't be plagiarizing them. Okay, so let's get it underway. And let's kick off with number 10 on my list. Probably the one with the most mainstream cred on my list. Also the one in this director's filmography that probably doesn't get the attention that it does other films, such as Escape from New York, The Thing, Halloween. Of course, I'm talking about John Carpenter. And the movie at number 10 on my list is The Fog. And it's just, whenever this movie's on, I'm just hypnotized by it. This goes back a long way. So when I was, when I was 10 years old, this used to get frequent play on network television. I remember ABC, Friday Night Movie. They played The Fog like 2-3 years after its theatrical run on television. And I actually got away with watching that at that age. It's probably not recommended for 10-year-olds, but I managed to watch it anyway. And I think it just harkens back. I think there's just a nostalgia factor in it for me. But I mean, watching it as an adult, I'm still mesmerized by this thing. And I think a lot of it is the atmospheric camera work done here by Carpenter with in regards to the ghosts and the fog surrounding them. It's just a hypnotizing movie for me, and I just couldn't leave it off the list. You may have seen it. Most people probably have, but there may be some people that haven't. Because The Fog doesn't get a reputation as being a great film. I think it's definitely underrated, and it comes in my list at number 10.
Oh, and that's a fantastic choice. I love The Fog. And, it's funny you say that about the ABC Sunday Night Movie of the Week, because there's an Easter egg in the Scream Factory release that does the intro for the movie from ABC's Movie of the Week.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I need to check that out. I don't have that version of the movie.
And it is definitely, it's also the kind of film, like, it's not necessarily great for 10-year-olds, although Lord knows I was watching it then, but it's one you could actually show on network television because there's not a lot that needs to be edited out. It's just a very taut, suspenseful film, and one with incredible atmosphere. I mean, it's another of Carpenter's collaborations with Dean Cundey, and I'm not sure we've gone a show without mentioning him at this point because he's just such a brilliant cinematographer.
Right.
It's really an atmosphere. I mean, Carpenter's films always have wonderful atmosphere, but The Fog is such a classic styled horror film from him, which I think is one of those things people may have glossed over a bit because it doesn't have that apocalyptic fervor of even something like Prince of Darkness and The Mouth of Madness, which aren't like major Carpenter films, but they might be a bit more representative. And of course, it's not one of the iconic ones like Escape from New York, Halloween, or, you know, The Thing.
Yeah. And another thing about Carpenter is that he was able to actually convey horror a la Halloween, The Thing, and Fog without resorting to gore, which is one of the things about Carpenter. He's more about the mood and the atmosphere and the tension than he is about the actual act of, you know, killing someone off.
Oh, definitely. I mean, so much of The Fog, so much of Halloween is mood and dread. It's, you know, Halloween, I think, short shrift for how strange some of the image are in a totally normal environment. And The Fog, whereas the fog, like, the environment, like, transforms over the course of it. I mean, it's really into something totally surreal. It's really a remarkable achievement, and I don't think it gets enough credit for it.
Yeah. So, once again, number 10 on my list, The Fog. So, over to you, Joel.
Well, number 10 on my list, after you sent me your list, I purposely tried to mirror some choices.
Oh, okay.
So, I went with a hypnotic horror film of my own, which is 1957's Night of the Demon, also known as Curse of the Demon, by Jacques Tourneur, which I'm probably butchering pronunciation of because I don't speak French. But this is a film that it's an acknowledged horror classic, but it seems to get a lot less attention than it deserves. I think of it as part of like this perfect trilogy between like post Val Lewton and post Universal, but pre like Hammer, along with The Innocents and The Haunting. And it's the only one of those three to not have a Criterion release yet. And I don't know how that's possible, but it's got Dana Andrews, who most people would know from Laura, from The Best Years of Our Lives, The Oxbow Incident, which is one of my favorite westerns of all time. Just phenomenal classic actor. It's based on a classic short story, which I definitely suggest anybody read, by M.R. Jane, called Casting the Runes. And the whole plot is that Dana Andrews runs afoul of a Satanist who basically curses him with these magic runes that he places on him when he's not looking, that curse that fate him to die in 7 days. Kind of ringish, but it's so much of this film, like, it's less visceral than The Fog, but so much of it is suggestion, is mood. I mean, you know, this is all I say post Val Lewton, but Tourneur, of course, worked with him on Cat People and a number of other great horror films. And this is definitely him at a late career best, doing some amazing things with mood, with environment, and with a really. He didn't tend to work with villains. A lot of it was a psychological suggestion, but here he's got Niall McGuinness has the very affably evil Satanist Carswell, who is probably, like a lot of satanic horror characters from the first half of the century, probably a reference to Aleister Crowley.
Okay. Yeah, I think a movie like this, you know, from the 50s, you know, that's during a repressed era, and having, I guess, an occultist or a Satanist in your film is probably rare to see back in that era, I want to say.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a weird era because, of course, before Hammer became eminent, most of the horror you're getting is tinged with sci-fi. So you're getting, so you know, things like The Fly or, you know, Thing from Another World. You know, one of the films I thought about putting on my list, X, The Man with the X-Ray Eyes. Like, there's a lot of, you know, really stunning horror films at the time, but they're all very grounded in science or science fiction. So to do, like, a very classic sort of, I wouldn't necessarily call this like a Victorian or Gothic film, like the Universal ones or even some of the Luton ones, but, you know, a classic sort of moody psychological horror film with really, you know, really stark lighting, hypnotic visuals. Like, that wasn't as prevalent around this time, except for, you know, the Innocence and The Haunting. So I think it's been sort of unfairly ignored because people just don't know where to place it.
Yeah, it's definitely not a product of its time. I think it's just it's different for that era, and so I think it does stand out a little bit more than it would in, say, like the late 60s, early 70s. So, was it Curse of the Demon? Joel is number 10.
Yep. Or Night of the Demon. Curse, I believe, is the name they use for it. Part of the issue with Curse also is that there were a couple of different versions. I think Curse of the Demon is the one that was trimmed down. It loses about 10 to 12 minutes. I mean, there was a lot of studio meddling in this one, like placing an actual demon into a couple shots in the film above the objections of pretty much everyone else who worked on it.
Yeah, just on the side of from this, I use IMDb for a lot of my movie review ideas, as well as in my VHS hunts. I make a lot of lists on IMDb of stuff from different eras, and just a lot of films. I'm finding a lot of films, you know, pre 1980, maybe even 1975. Go through so many title changes that it's really hard to pin down when you're searching for something, you know, for a physical copy of something.
Oh yeah, I mean they get changed in different markets, different countries, different regions. Yeah,
they get edited for television.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they get re-edited and put through the drive-through circuit a second time, so people will buy it again. I mean, generally speaking, pretty much every release of this film, and not sure there's a Blu-ray, but there definitely is a DVD, has both versions. Night of the Demon is the full cut, and Curse of the Demon is the shortened cut, but both of the, typically a DVD will have both of them on it.
Okay. All right, Joel. Let's get to your number 9.
Well, my number 9 is a film that, first of all, I recommend with some trepidation because there's a lot of weird shit in this one.
That's what we want to hear.
Yeah, somewhat uncomfortable shit. This is Echo Echo Azurak, Wizard of Darkness from 1995. Okay. It's based on a 70s manga. There's actually more than three of these films, but the original run of these films with the same actress, there were three of them, directed by a female director, Shimiko Sato, who I'm not really familiar with her other work aside from the first two Echo Echo Azurak films, but she also did work on some Resident Evil video games. This is sort of a take on the magical girl genre, but it's not really Sailor Moon-ish. Your main Misa, your main character, is a witch who's basically dispelling the work of cultists throughout Japan. And it's a strange film because there's a lot of strange sexuality. There's a lot of, like, splatter gore in it and a lot of high school relationship stuff. I think the closest comparison I have would be kind of a more down-to-earth version of Haozu.
Okay.
The 77 Japanese horror film that Criterion released. So it is, you know, it's funny and it's weird and it's often very uncomfortable and over the top, and it's just, you know, be a lot of Japanese genre films based on manga, especially live action ones, like the emotions are huge. Like, there's no doubt what these people are feeling. It's just, it's a really interesting, weird little film. You know, all the entire series is really fun and weird and grotesque and cool. Like, it's definitely it's a popcorn film that's also gonna, like, make your friends wonder what the hell is wrong with you, and there's not enough of those.
Well, I can't say that I've seen this one, Joel. I haven't actually made my mark in the in that realm just yet. You definitely sell it as a unique, one of a kind film, however.
And they are all available in America on Region 1 DVDs, so they're definitely accessible. Like, I first saw them through Netflix through the DVD subscription back when people still did that. And
hey, I still do that.
No, I would still do that too, but I have so many DVDs of my own now.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I've canceled the streaming side of Netflix, and I'm just offering up the DVD side.
Oh no, Netflix streaming was designed by Henry Ford. You can have any color you like as long as it's House of Cards.
Exactly. You know, that's a rant for another day.
Yeah.
We're going to move to number 9 on my list, and this is another one that I cheated just a little bit with. It's from you know, from Miramax in 1995, and got a bit of a cult following, as do the sequels. It's The Prophecy, starring Christopher Walken, and the only reason I'm recommending this is because this is probably my favorite Christopher Walken performance as Gabriel, the angel. Basically, this is Walken. He basically plays Christopher Walken, except with a much darker, more violent edge than I've seen him in anything else. The movie, it's the plot of the whole movie itself, and of that of the sequels, is basically Christopher Walken plays Gabriel. He's on Earth trying to find the soul of a dead army general who committed many atrocities in Vietnam, or was it Korea? I can't remember which one now, but regardless, it was in one of them, and he wants him to lead an army of angels in war against man. And basically, the soul is kept inside a little girl, thanks to Eric Stoltz. And, you know, essentially, Christopher Walken is just chewing scenery throughout the movie. There's also a nice turn by Viggo Mortensen as Lucifer at the end of the film, so another noteworthy performance there. But Christopher Walken sells this for me, and hence The Prophecy comes in at number 9 on my list.
Yeah, and The Prophecy, for as many sequels as there were, seems to be sort of an overlooked horror film, and I don't know if that's just because there's a lot of big concepts, but it's a very grounded, very somber film. So I don't know if it's just not something that a lot of people are looking for most of the time when they're, especially horror hardcores, like, if it's just not something they're looking for, watch it. But the performances are so compelling and so big enough that it's definitely worth a look. I mean, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Viggo, because I thought he was just wonderfully sinister, like, in his role. And of course, Christopher Walken, like, it's just a great over-the-top performance. And it's so weird, because there's all these big performances against this very somber, moody atmosphere. It's a real, like, dissonant feel to it.
Yes, exactly. And so I think, believe it or not, I'm going to say that Walken, I think, actually brings some levity.
Yeah.
To considering the nature of his character, he actually brings a lot of levity to the film with his dialogue. It's just... just awesome. There's no other way to put it. I think this is the ultimate Walken performance.
it would be hard-pressed to find one, a starring Walken performance that's more representative of what he is and what he does.
Yeah. Yeah, he's quite comical, and yet at the same time, he's also very sinister in this film. All right, moving on now to number 8 on my list, and I'm going to go into the martial arts realm here, and this is probably another well-known film, but I'm not sure how, you know, how this one gets a little bit overlooked because of, you know, something like Enter the Dragon. But number 8 on my list is Game of Death, starring Bruce Lee. And the concept of the film, basically the climax of the film, has Bruce Lee going through various floors or levels of a building, meeting a different martial arts master on each floor to get to the end, to save the day. And I just find this to be a very, I think this inspired a lot of, it definitely inspired a lot of video game work. When, you know, back in the video game days, when you had a boss on each level that you had to beat. I think Game of Death probably was a big influence on that. Especially, do you remember the old NES classic
Kung Fu?
Kung Fu,
yes. I knew that you were going to mention it. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, Game of Death is a really interesting choice because it's a film that sort of everyone knows the iconic images and knows the influence, but it's a film that I always feel like gets referenced more than it gets seen, weirdly enough.
Yeah, the iconic images you're talking about, of course, he's got the black and the yellow and black striped, you know, tracksuit throughout the film, and then of course the iconic fight with basketball legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And yeah, like I said, very influential on the video game world. I have a copy of Kung Fu. I have a retro gaming system, and I have the actual original NES Kung Fu, and I still can't beat it. To this day, I can't beat it. I couldn't beat it back then, and I still can't beat it. I can't seem to get past the wizard boss on stage 4. But anyway, also I think it was very influential in films. I think The Raid: Redemption from 2011. I think kind of borrowed from Game of Death with the fact that, you know, they're having to make their way up into an apartment building floor by floor, running into trouble on each floor. I kind of think my own theory is that, you know, The Raid was inspired by Game of Death.
Oh, I think anytime you see like a gauntlet style plot in a an action film or a martial arts film, like the echo of Game of Death is just inherent.
Yeah. And of course, everyone knows the story that this was the movie that was being filmed when Bruce Lee died, and so there will be scenes in this film shot from different angles to not give away the fact that that's not Bruce Lee throwing kicks. It's probably more well-known for that aspect than for the actual movie itself. So, number 8 on my list, Game of Death.
Yep. And number 8 on my list, I also wanted to choose a Kung Fu film here. So I'm choosing a Shaw Brothers one from 1971, Duel of the Iron Fist, which on DVD is known just as Duel, which is, you know, demonstrably not as cool a title as Duel of the Iron Fist.
No, just the Duel.
In front of it. Also, it's like there's major chance that whenever you're searching the Duel, you're just going to get the Spielberg film.
Yeah, probably.
So this is directed by Chang Cheh, who's, you know, probably the all-time great Shaw Brothers director. I mean, One Armed Swordsman, Kid with the Golden Arm, I've got House of Traps, Five Deadly Venoms, just, oh, so many films in different styles, kung fu films, wuxia's, swordplay films, even period dramas the dude did, and just everything with a ton of energy and style. Phenomenal director. Two of the most, and also, he was the one who directed the weird and amazing Shaw Brothers Hammer films crossover, Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
Oh, yes. I love that movie.
And the lead kung fu actor in that, David Chiang, is one of the lead actors in Duel of the Iron Fist, along with Ti Lung. Two of the most common protagonist actors from the Shaw Brothers' work. Just two great personalities. I mean, Ti Lung is the very sort of strict, repentant personality. David Chiang is playing my all-time favorite martial arts character, the Rambler, who I honestly think was an inspiration on Han Solo. when you see him in this film with his white shirt and black vest sauntering around, like, it's so Han Solo. This is like, it's so weird. It's so interesting in a film that it's not really quite modern. I'm not sure the era it's set based on the fashion and the political context of it. I'm guessing early 1900s. It's just constant huge fights, awesome fights. David Chiang just swaggering around like he owns the joint. It's just a perfect, straightforward kung fu film, and it's just an absolutely perfect, like, classic heroic bloodshed. Two very different personalities are forced to stick together and take on the entire world.
Yeah, and you know, this, I'm pretty sure this film has been, network, the El Rey network, they offer up quite a bit of Shaw Brothers films in their martial arts offerings. I'm pretty sure Duel of the Iron Fist has been on there a few times. For anyone who's into, 70s, early 80s martial arts films, El Rey is probably a good network for you, because they offer up quite a variety of them. So you may want to check out El Rey for something other than Lucha Underground.
Oh, definitely. And, this is one I bring up because it is available on DVD, but for some reason, this is one of the Shaw Brothers films that, I don't know if it's a rights issue, Dragon Dynasty has not put out. It was a different company that released this one, so I don't know if we're ever going to get, and the DVD release is fine, it's just so underseen, partly because it's not part of that Dragon Dynasty set.
Yeah. So, Duel of the Iron Fist, Joel's number 8.
All right, let's move on to number 7 on my list, which I went for. I know I'm sort of drowning us in Asian cinema right now, but I wanted to go with, I'm a huge fan of Asian gangster films, Yakuza films. I wanted to go with one of my favorites from one of the, probably the iconic director of this genre, Kenji Fukasaku, who most people know from Battle Royale, of course. This film is 1971's Sympathy for the Underdog, also known as Gamblers in Okinawa.
Okay, yeah.
And, it's definitely one of the best Yakuza films. It's not as complicated. It's a great way into Yakuza films because it's not as complex, not as sprawling as Battles Without Iron Humanity, that kind of long term years spanning saga. It's just, you've got a great stoic, angry hero who's just come out of prison. Like, his gang's in disarray. He starts up a gang with whatever misfits and loyal old friends he can find, and he's comes into some success, but ends up pissing off all the larger, more corporatized gangs that have developed in the time he's been in prison. The more respectable syndicate style gangs. And it just leads to a huge territory war, and one of the absolute best climaxes you'll ever see in a gangster film. I mean, and I'm absolutely lightning suicide run it just brilliant sequence. I mean, you know, it doesn't get as much attention as, of course, Battles of Iron Humanity, because that's, you know, that's his masterwork. That's his huge, sprawling, big work. And of course, it's not as much an iconic thing as Battle Royale, but it's if you ever wanted to get into Yakuza films and really see what happens when a gangster film comes from a different perspective, we tend to do more family-oriented gangster films, like in the sense that they're family sagas, that they're you know very somber, like very somber dramas full of close personal relationships falling apart and through like complex political betrayals. Yakuza films usually don't have time for that shit. Things are writ large. Betrayals are big, and they're sudden. There's the, you know, people are forced into corners, and they fight their way out or die trying. Like, they're very, even the complex ones, there's a directness and urgency and a vitality about them that I love, compared to ER very sort of portentous, very dreary, like Godfather inspired gangster films. And I'm not a big Godfather fan. I respect the film, but it's just not the kind of crime film I really dig.
Right. And I get what you're saying there. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. I need someone to like bear a dagger and scream at the heavens. I don't like, I don't need someone.
Yeah. So no one's going to begrudge you that fact, Joel. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I'm sure there's some Godfather fans out there listening right now, trying to track down your email address.
Bristling.
Yeah. No, I'll go get that Joel LaPuma. Yeah. But I haven't. This is another one on your list that I have not seen, and so I don't have anything I can add to what you've already eloquently put down. But you're definitely doing a good job on selling these lesser-known films. Yeah, no kidding, you are. And my journey into Asian cinema is only limited to a handful of Chinese police action dramas, like you know, John Woo's Hard Boiled. I haven't gotten into any Japanese cinema a whole lot. So I definitely need to catch up to speed with you there and get on that level. Some of these sound very, very good.
Yeah, I'm glad I could sell you on those. I mean, that's the thing. In making lists, I found myself sort of gravitating away from horror films, because the horror community is so always in conversation and so closely knit that it's really hard to find horror films that haven't been overturned yet.
Yeah, it does. I guess there's an oversaturation there as well. I mean, here I am, you know, on my VHS hunts, and I actually want to track down, you know, 80s horror films, and these groups, these member groups I'm a part of, there are people with like 4 or 5 copies each of, you know, I was like, oh, I'm never going to find this movie. And then, you know, there's several people with like, you know, several copies of it, and I'm like, oh my goodness. So yeah, I mean, there's definitely an oversaturation of that, especially in this era now, in the digital era with streaming. You know, if you go on Netflix, how many independent horror films will you find on there? You'll find dozens.
Oh yeah.
And so yeah, definitely you know, bringing to light some of these other genres, you know, shedding some light on some of these is very beneficial, because no one will think of, you know, venturing down that road.
And I think a lot of these genres, all the genres we're talking about have some kind of niche fan base, but something like Kung Fu or Yakuza films, the niche fan base is so, like, is so deeply in that realm that there's not necessarily a lot of crossover sometimes between that and like a general cult audience, or like the huge horror cult audience, which tends to be a bit more sprawling. So you know, it's really hard to get into some of the stuff beyond the big names that have spread enough for everyone. Now, it's really hard to dig through and find more obscure stuff because there's so much of it and you have so little guidance.
Exactly. And so that's what your list is actually producing, is a lot more obscure stuff. And I think it's very interesting from that aspect. And hoping that these lists can actually provide some people with, you know, some jumping in points on some of these different genres. Speaking of which, we're going to jump to number 7 on my list. And when it comes to 70s gritty police action dramas, you know, a lot of people think of The French Connection first and foremost. You know, going back further than that, even Bullet with Steve McQueen. The 70s were very good at producing a lot of these type of films. These were films that were driven more by the police work itself than the characters. But I'm going to go with one that sometimes gets overlooked in that realm. And number 7 on my list is The 7-Ups, starring Roy Scheider. And basically he heads up a group of cops. They're called The 7-Ups because the guys that they bring down have committed crimes that net them 7 years or more in prison. And this latest case, one of their brethren, one of the members of the gang, is actually shot and killed during an investigation, which leads to one of the more underrated and spectacular car chase scenes in cinema history. The car chase scene in The 7-Ups with Roy Scheider behind the wheel is just fantastic. And I don't have my notes for this in front of me, but the guy he's chasing is the same driver as the guy Steve McQueen was chasing in the famous car chase scene in Bullet.
Yep.
It's the same stunt driver.
Yeah, I believe that is Bill Hickman.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
Who also, man, who was not only a stunt driver, but also helped choreograph the chases in Bullet and French Connection. So there's a great you know, thread running through this. I know, you know, I haven't actually seen 7-Ups, which is, I'm kicking myself because I love Roy Scheider. But I know the director, Philip D'Antoni, he was the producer for Bullet and the French Connection. So, if you like those films, this seems like an obvious next step to take, of course.
Yeah, that would be the triple threat right there. Bullet, the French Connection, and then this one, the 7-Ups. Just some just great. I just can't talk up this car chase scene enough. The abrupt ending to it also is one of the more insane endings to a car chase that I've seen. I mean, how Roy Scheider walked out alive, I have no clue. I don't want to give a spoiler away, but anyway, I want to give the 7-Up some props for being a very underrated, underappreciated, you know, 70s gritty police action drama, but also you have to check out that car chase scene. I believe that car chase scene actually can be found on YouTube. Runs about 10 minutes. Nothing like a good lengthy car chase scene, man. Especially one that's professionally crafted and edited, like the ones in these films that we're talking here. And, you know, kudos to Bill Hickman because he's actually a stunt driver that other stunt drivers should be looking up to. And so number 7 on my list, the 7-Ups.
Oh, and we're definitely going to have to do a Roy Scheider day on this show at some point. But I've got to see the 7-Ups, and we've got to talk about his stuff.
Yeah, Roy's good. I like Roy. We like Roy. Yeah. All right, we're going to move on to number 6 on our list, and then we'll take a break shortly after that. So, number 6 on my list, and this is one that I had to dig a little deep for, and it's kind of a take on the buddy cop comedy action. Except a little spin on it here is that both buddy cops are undead. Number six on my list is Dead Heat, from starring Treat Williams and Joe Piscopo.
Woo!
Yeah, we got a Joe Piscopo movie on the list.
Finally.
And it's not Donnie Dangerously. and you know what? You got Joe Piscopo and Vincent Price together on screen. You cannot say that about too many movies. But that is definitely one for the Hall of Fame right there. Joe Piscopo and Vincent Price. Basically, the cops come upon a bank robbery or a robbery attempt that is actually being conducted by two undead guys, two undead hoods. They find out that they're undead when they shoot them, and the bullets don't do anything. And they track down the whole thing to this chemical company that's been conducting these crazy experiments with bringing people back from the dead. And so eventually both guys end up dead in one way or another and brought back. And they've got only a limited number of hours to solve the case before basically they start to melt into a pile of ooze. as far as the comedy part goes, you know, it's got its moments. I wouldn't go out and say it's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I just think the whole... It's just a unique concept. You know, you've taken one trope of movies, which is the buddy cops, and you've just given it just this unique spin with the zombie experiments and making these buddy cops into undead zombies who trying to continue their police work and solve the case just made it just an interesting choice for me, and so it makes number six on my list. It's Dead Heat.
And I have not seen Dead Heat, but I know it's been screened at a few locations. I think Alamo Drafthouse made it at some point. I know Exhumed Films in Philly's done it. I know it's always gotten a good reception. I should know its director, Mark Goldblatt, who also directed the Dolph Lundgren 89 Punisher, is a really accomplished filmmaker who did Terminator 1 and 2, who did True Lies, did Enter the Ninja, The Howling, Piranha, Humanoids from the Deep, I mean, Nightbreed, and is still working today. He did Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and apparently he did the editing on the upcoming Death Wish remake.
Wow. Yeah, he's keeping busy. This is probably not his most accomplished effort from the director's chair, but, I mean, it's got a cult following for a reason. It's just a unique spin on a very... very saturated trope.
Yeah, I mean, even by the late 80s, I would imagine most people were getting sick of buddy cop films. Just same thing all the time. So doing something really strange and unexpected must have been at least somewhat refreshing.
Yeah, definitely. So, and that's the reason why it makes my list. Taking a tired concept and just breathing a little bit of life in it, so to speak, considering it's about the undead.
And for my sixth choice, I also picked a strange, very idiosyncratic take on a classic genre trope, also by someone who worked on Piranha. This is Brother from Another Planet, written, directed, and edited by John Sayles.
Yeah, dude, this is a great film. This is one of the ones I've seen.
This is a remarkable film that I am shocked doesn't... I guess I'm not shocked it doesn't get as much attention as it should, because it's very strange and it's not what people expect. The title is very misleading. It sounds like it's going to be, you know, a really whimsical or outrageous kind of blaxploitation film. It's not that. The main character, who's just a brother, is an escaped alien who's also clearly an escaped slave alien fleeing a planet, who's hiding in Harlem, portrayed wordlessly, no dialogue, by Joe Morton, who most of our listeners will probably know best as Miles Dyson in Terminator 2, and also know from Executive Decision.
Yeah, and and he was in Speed that I just reviewed for Retro Movie Nerd last week.
Of course,
week.
Now, and he's just an anomalous actor, often doesn't really get, he's often in very functional roles, doesn't really get the chance to show what he can do. Here he's just, you know, sort of a fascinatingly earnest character, but surprising, but very oblique, a surprisingly dangerous character, although he, you know, it's born out of desperation. You know, it's easy to, watching the film, to view him as someone totally innocent and helpless, and then at various points in the film you get an idea of how capable he is, but he's just, he's really trying his best to evade all of this. And the interesting part of the film is not necessarily in that aspect of the film, although it's a great, you know, it's a great through line for it, but just his interactions with just normal people who sort of, because he's so quiet, because he's almost kind of a blank to them, they just unload their entire personalities, all of their angst, all of their experiences onto him because he's there to, because they just view him as someone who is going to listen, and he ends up being sort of a vessel for the film for people, for other characters to reveal things about themselves they might not have otherwise elucidated or might not even be aware of. It's just a really interestingly thoughtful, contemplative film. And it's absolutely not what you're expecting. It's a very intelligent, very, very thought-provoking film. And it's, you know, I should mention that he, you know, as part of that through line, I was imagining he is being chased by two men in black types, who are, of course, white guys, and one of which is John Sayles himself, one of which is David Strathairn, who most people will know from a variety of things, the later Bourne films, but especially as Edward R. Murrow in Goodnight and Good Luck. You know, Joe Morton in this, the brother, he's got telekinetic powers, he's also got like sort of this power over electric machines, which of course makes him incredibly useful. But there's a sense that he's not really, as difficult as it is for him to adjust the world around him, he's not really being exploited. He's just become sort of awkwardly finding his way into the community and ends up being sort of a link for all of them in a way that's not overdone or not cheesy. It's just a film about drawing connections between marginalized people, and it's a really remarkable singular film.
Yeah, it's definitely one of Sayles' stronger films in his filmography. Probably my second favorite behind Lone Star.
Oh, Lone Star is right.
Yeah, but this was just Joe Morton without any lines of dialogue, just a strong performance from him without even having to speak. You know, everything's in just his actions and his expressions, and just Morton's finest hour as an actor. And just credit to Sayles also for, you know, coming up with an idea that could have been laden with cliches and just, giving it some thought and intelligence.
I always feel like this is him doing sort of a take that to E.T., like taking that, like, alien assimilating into a human world narrative, but making it about something more than just, like, nostalgia or childhood, like, wish fulfillment.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that statement. This isn't something like, you know, Howard the Duck or anything like that. This is a very, the title might lend itself to comedy, like you mentioned, some kind of, you know, blaxploitation comedy, but it's definitely not that, and that's a very good recommendation, Joel.
I try. Just to reiterate for our listeners, this is not Homeboys from Outer Space.
It is not. With that, Let's take a break for a few moments, catch our breath a little bit, and when we come back, Joel is going to kick it off with number 5 on his list. So hold on with us. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, A Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back to Go Home in the Box as we continue with our list, the only list, the essential list that you will need to hunt down some movies. We call it Top 10 Movies You Must See, if you haven't done so already. And we left off at number 6. It was just a quick rundown. Actually, let's do a quick rundown to get people caught up here. Joel's list, number 10, Curse of the Demon, or Night of the Demon. Number 9, Echo Echo Azarak, Wizard of Darkness. Number 8, Duel of the Iron Fist. Number 7, Sympathy for the Underdog. And number 6 was Brother from Another Planet. My list, number 10 was The Fog. Number 9, The Prophecy. Number 8, Game of Death. Number 7, The 7-Ups. That's not a coincidence. That's just how it happened. And number six was Dead Heat. So, we come in from break with our top five. And, Joel, let's kick it off with your number five.
Well, number five is probably the movie on my list. And it's one that horror fans will definitely know, or at least be familiar with the reputation of, and that is Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark.
Yes, awesome.
It's just an awesome, perfect genre film. I mean, for those of you who may not have seen it, you know, this is a vampire western released after the success of Fright Night and Lost Boys, but somehow not able to capitalize it on that on the like during that time. It was kind of a bomb, and I think the company that made it, it was being distributed by the De Laurentiis Entertainment Group. I think they were sort of falling apart by that point. So it kind of got shafted. And for a film with as accomplished a cast and producers, I mean, you know, in the cast, you've got Lance Henriksen, Bill Paxton, and Jeanette Goldstein all coming in from Aliens. Catherine Bigelow, of course, the first woman to win Best Director Oscar, which it's remarkable to me that this film is not like a household name after she won for The Hurt Locker. You know, you've got Tangerine Dream doing the soundtrack, and it's just a brilliant sort of Bonnie and Clyde-ish outlaw gang on the run narrative, but with vampires. So there's a very almost ragged street urchin desperation about everything that happens in this film. I mean, you know, it's not just that they're causing chaos to cause chaos. Like, although Bill Paxton in that is very much aligned with that, they're sort of these lost, miserable souls, just desperate to survive. It's just taut the whole way through. Tense, beautifully shot. I mean, there's this amazing scene where Caleb, the main character, who's, you know, slowly transforming into a vampire after his love interest May has started to turn him, you know, he's drinking from her because he's not at the point where he's really ready to drink from people, right in front of a pumping oil well. And it's shot in like this, these stark silhouettes, and it's just, it gives you, with how big the shot is and how, and yet how penetrative it is, it just gives you the idea of this landscape has just an ongoing circle of expectation the entire way through. I mean, they sort of toss off hints that Lance Henriksen fought in the Civil War for the South, that they accidentally or possibly purposely started the fire in Chicago. I mean, they're just, it becomes almost sort of a Blood Meridian thing where it's about a legacy of American violence, but it's not as pretentious as Cormac McCarthy can get.
Yeah, this is definitely a solid pick here, Joel, and one of my favorite vampire films. And like you, I'm surprised it doesn't get enough accolades that it probably deserves, and who's at the helm and who's in the cast. You know, we mentioned this in a previous show about Bill Paxton. When he passed away, you know, everyone, the in memoriam on the internet, on television, they were, you know, going on about, you know, Aliens, his role in Aliens, his role in his minor, relatively minor role in True Lies, you know. But Near Dark didn't get any, love in the, you know, Bill Paxton segments. And so, you know, Bill Paxton has an extensive, you know, catalog of films that he's been in. A lot of them are quite good. And we just thought Near Dark is probably one that should be at the top of people's list when they want to watch Bill Paxton, you know, give a good performance.
Oh, definitely. He's just so wonderfully crazy in this. Lance is so intense and so you know, vulturous. It's just so a film with a ton of texture, like a just wall-to-wall great characters. It's just a classic outlaw kind of film and a classic vampire film. And I should mention a couple things. First of all, the cinematographer, Adam Greenberg, was cinematographer for Terminator 2, as well as a ton of films. The Big Red One, the Samuel Fuller war film, Iron Eagle, Alien Nation, Ghost even. He's done a lot of films, and he's great at doing big visuals. He's great at doing really memorable big visuals. He did Eraser and Sphere, Rush Hour. You know, a lot of great compositions. It is available on Blu-ray, but I haven't watched my Blu-ray copy of it yet. A lot of people seem to have issues with the digitizing of the picture. They said some films, when they get adapted into Blu-ray especially, have a sort of overly smooth look. As sort of people describe it as almost Vaseline or Clearasil-ish. Near Dark, a lot of people say that about the Blu-ray. I haven't watched mine yet, so I don't know how pervasive that is in the film. And also, it's sort of infamous for the last Blu-ray release of it having a new cover that was very clearly trying to trick people into thinking it was a Twilight-like film back when Twilight was in its heyday.
Yeah.
There is a love story at the center of it, and a very, you know, very weird, misfit kind of love story. It's not a melodramatic one.
And of course, you know, Twilight doesn't have any atmosphere or tone to it. Once that, you know, none that are discernible anyway.
I don't know. I thought the first one, Catherine Hardwicke's direction, actually had some lushness to it. But they didn't keep her for the sequel. I really should not be admitting I've seen Twilight films, but
oh, dude, you're so getting your ass kicked.
Lost all credibility. I don't think it's really a difficult thing to say Catherine Hardwicke's a good director, but Near Dark, it's not that film. I mean, the love story is a very sort of down to earth, sort of ragged misfit love story. You know, the film can go from very sort of, I won't say meandering because the tone is never meandering, but just the sort of sprawling Western feel to it, to sudden violence just in a blink. It's a film that really keeps you on your toes. Like, it's just a really unique kind of film, a unique way to do an outlaw Western, a unique way to do a vampire film, obviously, just a unique way to do an action film.
Yeah. Great pick, Joel. So Joel is number 5, Near Dark. My number 5, and I'm going from 1992. It's a sci-fi film starring Rutger Hauer. And you probably didn't see it because during its initial theatrical run, if you had blinked, you would have missed it. Did not fare very well at the box office. And it's Second Life. On the VHS market, has a cult following. My number 5 is Split Second. Basically, takes place in the future. The future is 2008 in this case, and global warming has caused the streets of London to flood. It may only be like 3 feet of water, but it's still flooded, and we've got a killer stalking people. Rutger Hauer believes this killer is the same one that killed his partner. And he's on the hunt for it. And he's one of those rogue renegade cops. You know, one of the tropes of 90s action films was that, you know, the cop had to be a renegade. And Rutger Hauer is that. And so it's basically renegade cop versus mysterious killer lurking in the shadows. It turns out that, you know, I might want to give a little spoiler warning here, but the killer's not human. And this movie's not perfect, but it is a very good film. I do want to make note of one incident in the film. There's a scene in the film where Rutger Hauer is at the police station, and he receives an ice chest that has a human heart inside of it. The heart has a huge bite taken out of it. Now, once you find out who or what the killer is, you have to recall that scene and and put two and two together and say, did that thing really send him an ice chest to his place of work? And so, yeah, there are some I think this film probably underwent several rewrites while they were filming it. I think it probably started off with one thing in mind, and then they decided to turn it into another. But the whole tone and atmosphere of this thing, this film, is kind of futuristic tech noir kind of. Certainly does have a Blade Runner kind of feel to it. And in fact, there's a scene that kind of recalls Rutger Hauer in Blade Runner when he's in his apartment and there are pigeons all over the place. So kind of like a little in joke there. And but the setting is kind of like a neo tech noir futuristic. You know, the London is underwater, but there are still nightclubs, you know, to sort through looking for killers, and the mostly British cast is filling out the role of the grizzled American character actors here. We've got Pete Postlethwaite in this film, some other faces that you might recognize from Harry Potter movies, I'm sure. But this is it's a very entertaining film. Like, you know, disregarding some of the gaps in logic, it's highly entertaining. It's filled with Rutger Hauer is a grizzled renegade cop, and he gets some pretty good one-liners in there, and he gets to choose some scenery. Number five for my pick, which I want you to check out, Split Second.
And, you know, I haven't seen Split Second in years, but I remember I was a big fan of it as a kid, because the scene that terrified me hearing about it even before I saw the film was the heart scene you just talked about. That became kind of a meme. My classmates, people were really, like, impressed with that. And Split Second is a really interesting case because, like you said, it is a very weird mashup of different elements, and it's hard to figure out where the inspiration came. Like, it's got that very, like neo-future noir. Like, it feels like it should have been in, like, an ongoing strip in 2000 AD, the British comic serial.
Yes, okay.
Like, it has that feel. I mean, there's a little bit of cyberpunkish texture to it. You know, the Killer in London thing, it feels like almost they were going for like a sci-fi Jack the Ripper kind of thing.
Yes, it did. That's another thing I wanted to lay out, was that with the killer. Now, they didn't really show the killer until like the last, say, 15 minutes of the film, and they only hinted at it throughout, but it definitely felt like they were trying to duplicate a Jack the Ripper kind of deal there.
Yeah, and that was, around this time, spoil it, but there were a lot of other science fiction tinged, like, Loose Hand Cop on the Edge films. You know, of course, The Hidden being my favorite, but, you know, this seems in with that bit, and especially in line with Dolph Lundgren's I Come in Peace or Dark Angel or Eve of Destruction.
Yeah, I also think it borrowed from, in terms of, you're going to end up giving some of this away, but in terms of the hunt or, you know, the killer aspect, it borrowed from both Alien and Predator.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely I think any time, like, in the late 80s, early 90s, when you're getting a cop hunting a weird killer thing, it's either, it's, you know, Predator, or it's coming from any of the sort of Thomas Harris-based serial killer films that are coming out around the time. And Split Second has two directors, Ian Sharp, who I'm not really familiar with, but the other director is Tony Malem, who did The Burning.
Yeah, Ian Sharp directed, I think, the climactic scene that took place in an old underground train station. He was responsible for directing that scene, but the majority of the film was Tony Malem.
Yeah. Oh, Ian Sharp actually did do second unit directing on Who Framed Roger Rabbit and GoldenEye.
So yeah, he's got some accomplishments under his belt.
So yeah, no, Split Second definitely like a perfect sort of popcorn pulp film.
Exactly.
It's stupid. It makes no sense. It's perfect.
Yeah, if you stop to think about a few aspects of it, you're definitely going to be like, what? Yeah, the whole heart in the ice chest thing really once the killer's revealed, I hearkened back to that scene. I was like, oh, wait a second, how can that go down like that? So I mean, I definitely thought it gave the impression that there were several rewrites done while they were shooting this movie.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. Also, because of course we've got a lot of crossover with Sex and the City fans. Kim Cattrall is your female lead in this.
Yes, and yes, there is a brief topless scene of her too. Just for notes purposes, if anyone wants to, if anyone's interested in that type of stuff. So,
Oh, I'm sorry, go on. What about Kim?
No, that's okay. I'm done.
No, I just wanted to mention that it was written by Gary Scott Thompson, who did the first two Fast and the Furious films.
Okay, so yeah, we've got some action veterans, action movie veterans behind the scenes of this, which is the reason why it ends up being a much better movie than it probably deserves to be. My number five, Split Second. Moving on. Number four on my list, and this is one that a lot of people may know, but then again, there's probably an equal number of people that probably aren't overly familiar with this. Came out in the 70s, 1975 to be exact. It's from Brian De Palma, Phantom of the Paradise.
Yes.
Yes. This is a crazy combination of Phantom of the Opera mixed with rock and roll, mixed with the classic tale of Faust, or Faust, if you're uneducated like I am. this is probably De Palma at his most over-the-top excess, directing-wise. This is just one batshit insane rock opera. You've got the main character is a guy. He's a songwriter, and Paul Williams, the great Paul Williams, wants his music. He has him supposedly killed, steals his music to create his own rock opera to open his new nightclub called The Paradise. And he made the mistake of not making sure he didn't kill the guy first, because he comes back as the Phantom of the Paradise, and he haunts the nightclub, and we got a little bit of glam rock going on in there. I thought Paul Williams was great in this movie. He actually kind of steals the show from me, more so than Phantom himself. And it's just one of those films that you've got to see. Basically, it's like if you take Tommy and gave it, some violence. I liken it to that. It's definitely Brian De Palma at his best in terms of just throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks, and makes my recommendation at number four.
Oh, and I can't recommend it highly enough either. It is just a phenomenal, completely distinct film. I mean, like you said, it is Phantom of the Opera, it is Faust, it is Picture of Dorian Gray, all done with Paul Williams playing. He almost comes across as like an evil Elton John.
Yes, that's what I couldn't put my finger on it, but yeah, it's like Elton John, but with evil intentions.
And, you know, Paul's just amazing in this. Of course, steals the show. It was nominated for and wrote the music for it. It was nominated for an Oscar for its score. Most people will know Paul by reputation, at least, because he wrote Rainbow Connection and wrote a number of big hits, including, you know, some Carpenter's hits, Rainy Days and Mondays, We've Only Just Begun. Phantom of the Paradise is actually a big favorite of Guillermo del Toro. Scream Factory has a wonderful Blu-ray of this that has del Toro doing some interviews with Paul Williams.
Yeah, I don't have that copy. I'm going to have to sort that out.
Yeah, that's worth the price of admission alone. I mean, your female lead here is Jessica Harper, who most people probably know from Suspiria, but is a really talented singer, who also took over the Janet role in the Rocky Horror Picture Show sequel Shock Treatment. She's just a phenomenal singer. Garrett Graham's in here has like this hilariously effete glam rock.
Oh, yeah, Beef. On stage, yes, Beef.
Beef. On stage, he's like an Alice Cooper badass, but, you know, like, off stage, he's a very camp gay type. You know, the whole thing is just basically camp gay gothic horror. Like, it's hard to find. You constantly have to, like, mash up descriptions to, like, try to explain to people what this film feels like.
Yeah.
In the end, it kind of just feels like Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique film in De Palma's filmography. I don't think he did anything like that afterwards. And this is rather early in his career, too. This is, precedes Carrie and Blowout and whatnot. So, I mean, definitely worth a check out. If you're a De Palma fan and you haven't seen this, this is probably the one De Palma film that I would, other than Carrie, this is probably the one De Palma film that I would give the highest recommendation to.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. A couple of trivia things. There's introductory narration, uncredited, from Rod Serling himself. And on YouTube, you can find a video. The whole soundtrack is written by Paul Williams. The songs are wonderful. One of them, called The Hell of It, he actually performed on the Brady Bunch Variety Hour.
Awesome.
You'll never get a more surreal moment than that. It's so wonderful.
Yeah, that pretty much sums up the film itself. Surreal, rock opera, Phantom of the Opera, Faust, shit, I don't know where else to go with that. It's just a bunch of things all rolled into one, and it's just totally, it's just more awesome for that.
And moving on, I also picked a music-oriented film, Fourth Choice. It's a much more down-to-earth film that I think is remarkable for its accuracy and veracity, which is Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Yes, sir.
It could broadly be described as a coming-of-age teenage music film, but it's a much subtler and smarter film than that sounds like. It's the only directorial effort from Lou Adler, who is produced a number of films, including, and stage theatrical shows, including Rocky Horror Picture Show and the sequel Shock Treatment, and is probably best known. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for his work as a producer. He produced a lot of classic albums, including Carole King's Tapestry, a number of her other albums, and a number of Mamas and Papas albums, including If You Can Believe Your Eyes and Ears. You know, a lot of youth-oriented music films can often come across as somewhat phony, I guess, if I'm turning into Holden Caulfield. when we talked about, you need an actual level of connection to a scene, especially if it's a real sudden, organic youth scene. Like we talked when we did Canon Films, we talked about Break-In, which had the advantage of having actual street dancers like be in major roles in that film, so it lent it like an accuracy that it would a sincerity it would have wouldn't have had otherwise. Fabulous Stains has that. I mean, the film is about actually stars young Diane Lane and Laura Dern. You know, Diane Lane is your main character, leads this mostly terrible, like, yeah, girl punk band called The Stains, but she but despite how bad they are, she like starts to attain this cult of personality because she is a legitimately angry, furious person. Her mother's died. She's basically supporting herself and her sister. Like, is she like teenagers actually are connecting to her because she's articulating what they're feeling, which of course is, you know, the inherent sort of core of punk rock. To go with that, there's a sort of rival, sort of friendly band, the Looters, that they tour with, who actually are made up of, have two of the former Sex Pistols, Steve Jones and Paul Cook, among them.
Right, yeah.
So there's genuine, like, punk credibility to this, which, I mean, if there's ever been a music scene more obsessed with legitimacy and credibility to a certain mindset or ethos, it's punk rock. I mean, the only thing that comes, I think, is hip hop, maybe heavy metal, but definitely of all of them, punk rock. It doesn't just see her as like some kind of ideal spokeswoman. She's a screwed up, damaged person. I mean, she's lost. This is basically her lifeline to like anything but staying in a terrible town, taking care of her family and working a terrible job with no education. Like, this is her way out. And, you know, she's so angry at the state of the world, at the state of her life, that like she really does have something to say, but it starts to get co-opted. Her look starts to get co-opted. I mean, it's very perceptive about how that happens to like legitimate music movements and youth movements. I mean, she starts to become disgusted because there's all this merchandise for them now. Like, everyone's adopting her like particular hair, weird, like, you know, choppy mohawkish hairstyle on her and her dramatic eye makeup. Like, you know, there's a lot they're trying to make her into a commodity, and she, you know, and at the same time, she's making herself into just as much of one, but for what she sees as more legitimate reasons. I mean, she's heavily sexualizing herself while ranting about how she never puts out. It's a very messy sort of, is this feminist? Is this like just a media creation? It trusts the audience to like come up with their own sort of answers to those questions, which is pretty much what you do listening to underground music anyway. Like, they're the questions you sort of have to deal with, even just engaging with pop culture in general. So, in the middle of all that, there's, you know, a really great characterization. I mean, there's a sort of traditional, like, I'm famous now, but this sucks kind of storyline. But it's not really dangers of fame so much as dangers of not be, of. It's not like, oh, I'm famous now, so I'm on drugs and I'm gonna OD. It's more about how much your sense of identity stays intact when the outside world intrudes on it.
Yeah, the thing with Yeah, I was going to say that the thing with, rock and roll films in general, whether they're biopics or whether they're, you know, fictionalized accounts, there's these trappings that a lot of these movies fall into, where the band finally gets their big break and they become a huge success, and then, internal things combust and separate the guys, and, you know, things fall apart, and then there's the big comeback at the end, and... this one doesn't really follow along with that and kind of sets its own course.
Yeah, it's a much more idiosyncratic and personal take on that kind of narrative. And, Caroline Kuhn, who's a classic punk journalist and political activist artist, she served as a technical advisor on the film. So I think they're really aiming for, like, not just accuracy on the punts, accuracy on like how this was affecting kids who were processing social and political issues for the first time, and how their view of it, and how especially like the female contingent of the punks scene, how they were reacting to the reacting to society through this scene. So it's a really interesting film that I don't think we've seen anything much close to that. I mean, Smithereens from around the same time is a bit close. I mean, for a modern equivalent, would probably be the Runaways biopic.
Yeah, which was a good one, by the way. But yeah, definitely strong choice here with your number four, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. Good pick, Joel.
Oh, thank you.
All right, so, well, let's get to number three on your list, Joel, as we're counting down here.
And this is going to take some words to explain this film, which I'm actually not sure. Like, sure the availability of it. This is a mental breakdown picture, the likes of which I don't think people have ever seen. This is 1978's The Mapu Cage, starring Carol Kane. You know, that whole, it's technically part of that whole what you'd call psychotic woman subgenre that birthed these psycho biddy films like Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, just like general mad woman films, but it's a very distinct thing. I mean, it's also known as Don't Ring the Doorbell, which it's sort of advertised as more of an exploitation film. It's much artier than a lot of like films of this style, I would say. Carol Kane lives in a dilapidated mansion with her older sister, who is much saner. Their father was a famous anthropologist, kind of a Jane Goodall type. So she spent most of her, you know, formative years in Africa, sort of growing up around tribal rituals, growing up around in the jungle, fascinated with apes, especially with jungle animals. And I'd like to point out that this is not like, when I describe it like that, we're already getting into some unfortunate implication territory about some potentially colonialist racist territory. It's not that, I think, partly because this is clearly her own frail temperament's take on what is otherwise seen as legitimate, like traditional African tribal rituals. And, you know, I don't know enough about like anthropology to really give an idea of like what African cultures specifically these are coming from. But, you know, she, over the course of the film, sort of regresses into her own idea of like a more primitive type, I guess. Like, she keeps an ape that she names Mafu in a cage. The ape dies, and she like repeatedly gets new apes that she has a weird sort of maternal and almost romantic relationship with. And she has a very sort of incestuous kind of fixation on her older sister as well. I mean, it becomes clear that like she uncomfortably attaches herself in a romantic and sexual way to anything that she's close to.
Okay.
Every attempt her sister and, you know, they had an old friend of their father's who serves as kind of like an assistant executive of their estate, any attempt they make to sort of curb this, to help her just become more sane, I guess, just veer away from this crumbling mental state she's in, like, it all works out in entirely the wrong way.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm not familiar with this one. This is another one on your list that I have not seen, and you know, considering that's from the 70s, I figured it may have some exploitation tinges to it. And it sounds like it's not too far from that.
It's almost like it's sort of using elements of exploitation to tell a more in-depth character study. Like, it's more about, I mean, there's a lot of exploitation films, like, I think of things like Deranged, you know, buried things based on it, like, or even Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, things inspired by that line of Ed Gein-ish narratives. Like, it's almost, it's sort of in league with those, but it's telling a story that's a bit less outrageous than that, a bit less gratuitous. I mean, a lot of it's about feeling trapped, it's about isolation, it's about, like, you know, about boundaries and attachment. It's, you know, there's not as much violence as, like, a lot of other exploitation films in that sort of madness category, but the violence that does happen is intense and shocking, so I think an exploitation fan would enjoy it.
Yeah, and that's a great lead into the number three on my list. I don't know how well known it is outside of the mainstream, but definitely from the 70s exploitation era. It goes by a few different titles. The one I know it under is Criminally Insane, but other people may know it as Crazy Fat Ethel, which is I think a much better title, if you ask me. But basically, low budget 70s exploitation film where the main character, named Ethel, is she basically all she does in this movie is eat and kill. Now, she doesn't eat what she kills, but she definitely likes to eat, and anything that gets in the way of that, she likes to kill. This is the best way to put it. basically, it's very the gore factor is definitely there. There's some hackies in it. It's definitely depraved, and it's very outlandish in its depravity. It's just completely over the top. It has a freak show appeal to it. This is one of those movies where, like, you know, in certain circles, you know, people would be like, oh, have you seen Crazy Fat Ethel? Oh, you gotta see Crazy Fat Ethel. That movie's just nuts. It's just, it's one of those movies where, you know, a lot of it doesn't really make any sense, and you don't, there's not really any, there's not really a lot along the lines of, like, character motivations. It's just like, people show up at Ethel's house and they get killed. I gotta recommend it just because it has that freak show appeal to it. I mean, everything on my list, has some appeal or another to it. Some people may not appreciate some of the violence in the film, but as in terms of just, you know, how people have to crane their necks when they drive past a car wreck scene, it's a lot like that. It's just, it has that, you know, freak show train wreck appeal to it, and it's definitely one of the more notorious exploitation films of that era.
Well, and, you know, it's not one I've seen, but it spawned kind of a almost a little niche for itself, because there was a sequel and there were a couple of follow-ups that are basically the same character that Priscilla Alden's playing, the two Death Nurse films.
Now, the sequel, Crazy Fat Ethel 2, was actually, shot on video. And the original kind of has that feel to it as well. It's very low budget. It looks like it costs like maybe $25 to film. but being from the 70s, it definitely has a different look and feel to it. But if that was to be filmed in, like, say, the late 80s, early 90s, it has that shot-on-video feel to it.
Oh, yeah, very much. I've seen trailers for the Deafness films, so I was a little familiar with this once I realized they were connected. I haven't seen these, but interestingly, there was a remake of Crazy Fat Ethel last year.
I did not know that. I wasn't aware of that. In my research, I didn't come across that.
Which, which is just absolutely insane. And for the first criminally insane, apparently they had a great and horrifically insulting theater gimmick that they would put a large industrial scale in the lobby of certain theaters where it was screened. Any woman weighing over 250 pounds was admitted for free.
Oh, my goodness. You could not do that now. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. No. Lawsuits. Oh.
Oh, my God. Like, the Alamo Drafthouse is getting yelled at for doing an all, like, woman-only screening of Wonder Woman. Like, I can't imagine. You know, that's something that would offend non-morons.
But,
the 250-pound scale,
that,
I mean.
That was a different era. It was a different era, and, you know, some things were, quote-unquote, acceptable more so than they were now.
Yeah, no, just a very strange moment. I mean, I'm assuming that this is sort of the grindy version of, like, a Psycho Bitty film. I think the only comparison I have that might fit the tone even a little bit is Mountaintop Motel Massacre.
Yeah, you can fit that in there. I think that's a good companion piece for it.
But yeah, I really got to watch this. It's looking insane.
And so number three on my list, Criminally Insane, a.k.a. Crazy Fat Ethel. moving on, we're almost through. We're at number two. I got a doozy for number two, Joel. And if you are a subscriber to the Shudder streaming service, I can't recommend it highly enough. You should subscribe because you will find this movie on there. My number two from 1982 is a mashup of the martial arts zombie films with a little exploitation thrown in. Well, not a little, but a lot. And it's just an all-out balls-to-the-wall mashup of all these B-movie genres that you can find out there. My pick for number two is Raw Force. And, you know, this is a movie, you've got your kung fu heroes, you got your zombie killers, you've got evil monks, you've got a guy that looks a lot like Hitler, the black market skin trade, apparently. And there's a whole lot going on in this movie. This takes place on an island that is known for being a burial ground of martial arts masters. And there's a cruise going on with a bunch of martial arts champs on board, go figure. And they want to visit this island. And what they run into is just a crazy, crazy amount of zombie swordsmen and martial arts masters and, evil, creepy, grinning, maniacally laughing monks. And we talked about throwing stuff at the wall when we talked about De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise. This is probably the epitome of that, just throwing up all these genres up in the air and catching what comes down. And so number two on my list, Raw Force.
Oh, only two words describe the power and fury of this unstoppable team: Raw Force. To anyone listening, go to YouTube and just watch the trailer. You will be sold on Raw Force. There is, of course, a wonderful Blu-ray of it from Vinegar Syndrome. It is. You've got Cameron Mitchell. You've got Vic Diaz showing up as an evil monk. It is. I'm not sure we can do justice to how weird this film is, because, of course, there's the, the hook, martial arts masters against zombies, classic, but most of there's scenes where they're just sort of, like, shopping around the Philippines. They're on a cruise. In the middle of the film, there's a birthday party for a character we've never met, and we get some very, like, sitcom-ish hijinks before, an inevitable ambush from the evil human traffickers. it's just, it takes time out to just introduce you to all these weird side characters who, like, never show up again. It's, I almost wish that this were, like, an ongoing TV series, that Raw Force was the new Love Boat.
Yeah, that would be kind of awesome, actually. A Raw Force Love Boat.
I would watch it like crazy. You know, the trailer makes it seem like it's almost like a proto Mortal Kombat. Like the characters sort of the characters they describe in the trailer sort of match up to Liu Kang and Johnny Cage and Sonya Blade. Right. Now, what's interesting is the female lead in this, who's the Sonya Blade-ish character, was not only Fonzie's girlfriend on Happy Days, but actually became a film historian later who worked to preserve Orson Welles' films.
Yeah, I wish he had worked to preserve, you know, Raw Force and the likes of that. Much more suited to her time.
Oh, man. But Raw Force is just, this is a film that just play for people and watch their reactions. Just watch them try to comprehend what goes on in Raw Force. It's a wonderful experience.
Yeah. So what you got for your number two?
Oh, my number two is not quite as insane, but it's leading towards that. It's the legendary Jack Hill Girl Gang film, Switchblazers.
Yes, sir. I remember this being revived by Quentin Tarantino back in the late 90s, I believe.
Yep, he did. It was one of the films he released under Rolling Thunder Pictures, which actually he released a number of great films under that. I mean, Chungking Express, Detroit 9000, Sonatine by Takeshi Kitano, Mighty Peking Men, even did The Beyond in association with Grindhouse Releasing, who I think ultimately released the Blu-ray at that, and also screens the restored one in theaters. Switchblade Sisters, which is also known as the Jezebels and like a million other titles, it's, you know, obviously, like, a gang movie is going to run into comparisons with The Warriors. Switchblade Sisters is not quite that. I mean, it's more about the relationships that form between these characters and how it all falls apart. So Jack Hill has said it was actually weirdly inspired by Othello.
Weirdly is one way to put it.
I mean, Patch in it, who is also one of the basis is of the Daryl Hannah character, right, in the Kill Bill movies, with the eye patch. She's like the Iago type, and in the commentary, Jack Hill talked about Patch as Iago. There's some really interesting stuff. I mean, it's on one side really campy and, you know, trafficking in a certain sort of after-school special melodrama, and one side like a really intense, awesome sort of classic gang film about loyalty and leadership. It's that weird perfect combination of like sleaze and camp and weirdly gritty accuracy. It's just a hell of a weird experience that is much like a much stranger thing than most people imagine going into the zone. I mean, there's scenes that are just insane camp, like, you know, a big fight in a bathroom at like a girl's juvenile delinquent facility where they're beating up on the you know, obviously sadistic lesbian warden, which is the kind of thing that could be culled from like any other woman in prison film until they start hitting her with a plunger. To like scenes that are actually kind of like, you know, almost Warriors-ish, almost Warriors-esque, or, you know, even just like blaxploitation-esque in their grit in terms of how desperate and, lost these characters are in an obviously cruel environment that just doesn't care about them. And yeah, at the same time, there's, one of the big antagonists is a sort of wannabe middle management politician, gang leader named Krabs, which is already amazing enough. Like who runs all these youth centers where he deals drugs and prostitutes girls out of that. He's got big political posters of himself on the outside. And he works with local churches to make it seem like a legitimate charity. It's just a lot of hilarious touches and a lot of intense drama at the same time. It's a hell of a movie.
Yeah, definitely a solid choice there. I mean, and of course, something like The Warriors has much more polish than Switchblade Sisters. All we talk about The Warriors since you mentioned that. Switchblade Sisters is a lot more raw and unpolished in comparison, and definitely grittier, and it's a solid number two choice, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, of course, not as polished as The Warriors, but once you get to scenes like that, like the knife fight in Shadow at the end, there's that rawness adds so much to the whole experience. It's a film that's constantly a surprise and constantly takes you to places you're not expecting to go.
Definitely. All right, Joel, that brings us to the number one film on your list. This is the movie that you have decided that people need to see, and why don't you go ahead and tell us about it?
Well, this is actually a film that's fairly available right now, but only... only in a set. It's the opening film in a legendary Japanese series. Me going back to my Japanese films, of course. First three, all by the same director, visually stunning and constantly inventive and provocative and strange and endlessly intense. This is Female Prisoner 701 Scorpion, starring Miko Kachi, Lady Snowblood herself.
All right, excellent. Very cool.
This one's also based on a manga. It's partly a woman in prison film, partly a revenge film, but it's so much more than either of those imply. I mean, it grabs you by the neck from the opening scene. Nami Matsushima, Miko Kaji's character, who will basically be known as Scorpion later on, is sort of a naive girl who's like the patsy of her crooked police detective boyfriend. There's a scene where I think in the opening it's like, she has sex with him. It must be like her first time, and there's blood on the sheets that gets, cross-cut into a waving Japanese flag. The film is effused with that kind of anger, because it's not like most women in prison films are just titillation. This, and obviously that's going to be an inherent element in anything in that realm, unless it's something like modern, like Orange is the New Black, where it's purposely trying to avoid that. It's a film about, it's a film about just suffused with anger at corruption, because it's just everywhere in this. And Scorpion basically becomes, this stoic, long suffering, almost wraith-like presence. She's got these wild eyes. She's willing to bear any amount of suffering because she knows she's going to get an opportunity to bring it back, to return it in kind and way more than the people putting her through hell are ever going to expect. It turns into, of course, she tries to tries to break out, of course, break out of prison. Like, she gains allies and enemies during her time in prison, and the whole thing becomes this. All these tensions that are pre-existing boil over into a huge prison riot, because the whole thing is that these tensions between all the prisoners are sort of just what they do because they can't get back at the people that really fucked them over, which, you know, is the warden, all the guards that exploit them, that beat them, that work them to death. Like, you know, that they can't get back at the people who are responsible for them being in prison. You know, all, you know, the corrupt cops and the pimps and the dealers that put them there. I mean, you know, this is, you know, so many exploitation films are about the corrupt cops, like the dealers and pushers and pimps. And this is about, this is suggesting that no matter how decaying society is, like how unfair it is for like certain classes of people, there's always someone worse off, and it's usually women. And I don't think that's too controversial to say at this point.
No, there's definitely a history there. We're all aware of that. You know, just look at most of the exploitation films from the 70s and how women were portrayed in those films. So, yeah, that's not a stretch. That's not a stretch, Joel. You're right.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, all these films are great, and there's definite arguments that the second and third are even better than the first, but of course you get start with first, just for, because it's an ongoing story. But just, you know, the intensity, the wildness in Miko Kaji's eyes, like the tense way she like poises to strike someone, like it's just, you know, a lifetime of anger and resentment at being exploited, being treated terribly. Like, you know, I always find it fascinating that these stories were so prevalent in Japan especially in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, like, because it, you know, they've always tended to be a more patriarchal society, one where women's rights came hard fought, and there's still work to be done. I mean, of course, there is here and everywhere else too, but I have to imagine a lot of this was sort of inherently about, because a lot of Japanese films at the time were about, you know, ongoing American occupation, ongoing prostitution of Japanese women for American soldiers. I mean, you know, so much of this, I think, is just born in anger at post-World War II Japanese society.
Yeah, so this is definitely a strong choice for your number one, Joel. And thank you for selling us all on it, because it sounds like something that, I mean, this is something that, you know, when someone recommends a film like this, you just need to see it one time, because, you know, if someone speaks highly of it, there's a reason for that. And so, I mean, solid reasoning behind your number one, Joel. And so definitely a very good, strong list that you gave us today.
Yeah, I would definitely thank you. And I would definitely say that, for all I'm talking about the social context, but it's also just, it's in, like, a compelling film. Like, there's a lot of lighting and effects, like just crazy camera work, like almost elastic camera work that, you know, vaults and moves everywhere. It's just, there's just a film suffused with like raw tense energy. And you know, the sequels probably are even better, because there's even stronger emphasis on style they're not so locked in, so there's more they can do. But this is such a great place to start, for even just start looking at revenge films. This is a great place to start. And it's a film that if you're in the mood for something intense that you're just going to want to be suffused in like that kind of tense cathartic energy. Like this is a film to look at.
And thank you for that, Joel. And speaking of style, that's going to lead us into my number one pick on this list. I'm going from 1986 with Michael Mann's Manhunter. Probably another one that maybe I cheated a little bit considering the criteria we laid out for ourselves. But when you talk about series of films that include Hannibal Lecter, you know, everyone talks about The Silence of the Lambs, and maybe even some of the later, like the Red Dragon remake, and of course Hannibal itself. But I feel that Manhunter is one that really doesn't get paid a lot of attention to, and it was the case when it was released as well. It had a very low-key release in theaters when it came out. And basically, you know, it tells the Red Dragon story. William Peterson plays the detective, you know, trying to track down a serial killer. He employs the assistance of Hannibal Lecter, who doesn't have a major role in this film, but a very interesting one. And for me, what sells Manhunter for me is basically Michael Mann. I'm a big Michael Mann fan. I want to revisit the Miami Vice TV series because that's just that whole 80s excess stylized action is something that appealed to me. But in this case, in Manhunter, his use of the score, the soundtrack in this film, really sells it for me. One of the climactic scene in this film is the killer, played excellently by Tom Noonan. Tom Noonan is one of the most underrated actors in our generation. Joel, you'll probably agree with that.
Oh, I am you know, here's the funny thing. I haven't seen Manhunter yet, but just based on his work in Monster Squad and House of the Devil, like, and of course, Last Action Hero, I'm a huge Tom Noonan fan.
Okay, so then you definitely need to see Manhunter then, because Tom Noonan is excellent in this film as the killer. And he has, in this scene, he has his victim holed up in the house. And Inagata DeVita is playing in the background. He likes to play music, you know, to, I guess, set the mood. I don't know. But at the peak of Inagata DeVita, William Peterson is lunging through a window to get inside the house. And it's done in slow-mo. And it's one of my favorite movie scenes of all time. Just those few seconds of tension and built up in there. With that music playing over everything, it was just awesome. And once you see it, you'll probably agree that that's a very well built, well crafted scene near the end of the film. Number one on my list, Michael Mann's Manhunter.
No, that's definitely a great choice. Yeah, like I said, I haven't seen it yet, but I know film's reputation, Scream Factory, I believe, has or will have released. Yeah. It's already been out for a bit.
It's been already.
Yeah, you know, I love Tom Noonan, and it's a film that definitely, I mean, the obvious obstacle for, I think, a lot of people like going out and seeing this is because it got overshadowed by Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, it certainly did. And William Peterson himself, I mean, I'm sure there's some CSI fans out there. I mean, CSI is probably one of the more popular TV shows of all time. But William Peterson had some action chops in him there in the mid-80s with To Live and Die in L.A. and then Manhunter after that. So, I mean, it's definitely... he's definitely an underrated... you know, action star in his own right.
Yeah, and this is an era where, like, I almost think Manhunter came out too soon. I mean, not just because Silence of the Lambs became such a definitive film for a lot of people, but this was an era where there wasn't as much emphasis on procedural style films or like true crime shows. All that stuff would start to become more prevalent in the 90s. I mean, and beyond. I mean, Law and Order, explosion of true crime books and like shows, what South Park like to call informative murder porn. All of that stuff starts to become really prevalent, a bit in the 80s, of course, but mostly by the late 80s, early 90s is when stuff really starts to take hold. Manhunter just sort of predated that trend. I think it probably did not get much attention because it just wasn't in line with what other people were watching at the time. I mean, like you said, Michael Mann, Miami Vice, like this kind of dark serial killer oriented story was just not what people were doing.
No, that's correct. And so it kind of got lost in the shuffle. And like you said, when Silence of the Lambs rolled out, I don't recall many people saying, "You like Silence of the Lambs? Then you got to see Manhunter." And one of those forgotten films, and I'm sure that there are some hardcore Hannibal Lecter fans out there. We know they're out there, and I'm sure they're well aware of this film. But for those of you that like a good police procedural, this is definitely more heavy on the problem solving aspect of a movie like this, rather than, and that's intercut with, of course, scenes of Tom Noonan being awesome. So it's my highest recommendation.
No, that's a great list, man. Thank you for that, because now there's a lot of films on that I actually really do need to check out.
So that is our top 10 list of movies that you need to see if you haven't done so already. We're gonna forego the double bill spill this week because it seems rather redundant since we've recommended 20 films to you already today. We don't need to recommend two more. And unfortunately, The Sinful Dwarf did not make either of our lists, Joel.
No, unfortunately.
And so, hence, once again, The Sinful Dwarf has been bumped from the show.
Well, I think The Sinful Dwarf's reputation sort of precedes itself. I'm not sure we needed to recommend it to people.
Way to butter him up, Joel. It kind of makes it easier when he emails me.
I'd rather curry some favor with The Sinful Dwarf.
Well, so I guess that's our show then this week, Joel. And I want to thank you very much for your input. Great list. And to those you listening to us from the Place to Be Nation Network, thank you for your ears. You can find us also on Stitcher, Google Play, and we're on Podbean as well. And so check us out when you get the chance. We've got a great back catalog that'll be uploaded there soon. This was our 10th overall episode, hence the top 10 list. That's just a little having a little fun with it. And we appreciate your ears on that. For Joel LaPuma, I'm myself, Chris Jordan. Thank you for listening. And remember your mom and pop video store, because it is the cornerstone of your nostalgia. We'll see you next week. In a god of a feed of honey, don't you know that I'm loving you? In a god of a feed of baby, don't you know that I'll always be true? Oh, won't you come with me and take my hand? Oh, won't you come with me and walk this land? Please take my in a god of a visa, honey, don't you know that I'm loving you? In a god of a visa, baby, don't you know that I'm